Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Claudia Monticelli with another episode of Multiple Voices. My Multiple Voices podcast, true to its name, includes different series. For example, we have the Voices of Love, where we discuss relationships, the voice of empowerment, the voice of laughter and play, the voice of pleasure, and the magical voice of archetypes and how they change the way we live. But we also have the voice of memory that includes everything from history to discussions of past life regression. There's also writing voices, where we interview both seasoned writers and authors who have just started getting their feet wet with writing, and we learn what can work for you as potential writers. Our series called Voice of the Spirit discusses different forms of spirituality and religion. And then Channeling Voices is a series that covers what happens when you channel, but is also extended to mediumship. Take a moment to review this podcast if you've enjoyed listening, and leave a hearty 5 stars. I'd appreciate it. Enjoy your listening. Ladies and gentlemen, we have another guest today. S.A. Bradley Scott is with me today. Say hello, Scott, to my audience.
Hi, everybody. Thank you so much, Claudia. Thanks for having me on. This is great.
Oh, it's a pleasure for me. I've been waiting for this a long time. And why? Because Scott literally is a horrible person. And yes. And it's a terrible thing to say, but the etymology of that will give me, you know, will tell me why I'm saying that. Horrible me comes from the Latin, and it really does talk of fear. And that's what he's all about, this horror genre in the media, in all different forms of media. And if I were to do my job properly, Scott, I would have to say that you're the host of a podcast. And the podcast yes. is called Hellbent for Horror. And that's, you know, yes. you don't get much of that around. Or maybe you do. You probably know your competitors. But that is some title for a podcast. I mean, you are an expert in horror, aren't you?
Well, yeah, it's one of those things that you become an expert through, like they say, attaining wisdom is usually from all the mistakes that you make. And I think in horror, it's all the craziness that's happened in my life. I've found a way to turn trauma into something that's entertaining in a way. So Hellbent for Horror is a podcast about everything related to horror. I talk about horror as art and social commentary, which most people don't necessarily look at it for that. I talk about movies and the books, the stories that kind of shaped me, but also those things that shape horror as a genre and art form. I think that culture shapes horror shapes culture.
Yes, it's like the media. I mean, we watch TV series, they represent women, men, and they influence us, but they take it from us. It's a reflective type of pattern. And why I like this is, well, you know, we were chatting right before I started, and I was telling you, I love those movies where you have to, you know, you don't want to see the next scene, and you cover your eyes, but you have to leave the slits open or else you won't be able to see. I just love that. Yeah. And I'm going to watch, as soon as we end this, I'm going to go go watch one.
That's wonderful, because that's what pleases me when I meet people. And a lot of times I'll say go to conventions and I'll be talking to folks, and a lot of times it'll be people who are horror fans, but inevitably I'll have someone who will tromp across the room just to tell me how much they dislike horror movies. You know what's interesting is that when I'm talking about horror with people who are horror lovers, we talk about 20 minutes. When I'm talking to someone who doesn't like horror, we talk about 20 minutes because everybody has a very strong opinion. And I think it says something about the primal nature of what horror is connecting with us about.
Wait a minute. Don't jump the gun. I mean, I have some before we get to that.
Oh, sure. Of course.
Because it's so important to go there gradually. now he explored the podcast, and Scott has talked about that. But, you know, it talks also about horror in comics, you know, as well, film, books, and music. Now, there's you were also an author
right? You have a book. Yes. The title is Screaming for Pleasure. And I love that title because my book is The Magic of Pleasure Seeking. So Screaming for Pleasure is right down my alley. How horror makes you happy and healthy. I love it. All right. Now, he's also, there are other serious things about this man. He's lectured at Webster University in the College of Idaho and performed his live show, My Horror Manifesto, in New York City and various horror conventions across the United States. Now we can talk. All right. So you mentioned in this very brief time we've spoken, that you have spoken twice, you said, that has shaped me from my childhood. Okay, now, before we get there, let me ask you, well, who were you as a child? Let's go into, let's say, the adolescence.
Okay.
All right, sure. How was that adolescence for you?
It was a rough start, let's put it that way. I was brought into a cult, basically. I was in a fundamentalist Christian cult that believed that the world was going to end in 1975.
Wow.
And so there was a lot of weird abuse that goes along with that.
Okay.
Psychological mental, and things like that. Yeah, a lot of mental stuff that happens. And
on
because
the
I'm
part
a kid
of
at that
both
time,
parents or the family at large?
Both parents. Mm-hmm. We were the black sheep. The rest of the family was Catholic. But my mom had some mental illness.
Uh-huh.
And in that mental illness, it showed itself in really kind of attacking the family, plus whatever was going on outside.
Yeah.
It was kind of undiagnosed at that point. And so before we knew it, before I knew it, we were suddenly in this cult that said the world's going to come to an end in 1975.
Now, do you have
believed in numerology.
Siblings? Do you have brothers, sisters as well?
I do have, I have a younger sister. I have two sisters, but one that was around at that time, a younger sister.
Mm-hmm.
And she's still, I mean, the funny thing about this cult is it was kind of shown as a fraud.
Mm-hmm. How much
because
difference?
Because the world didn't end in 1975.
Right. How much difference between you two?
1 year.
Uh-huh.
So
very close.
Amount,
very close.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was still the older brother.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a lot of the weirdness of the brunt of everything that was going on. So I was a very scared kid because one of the things in this religion was that everything was a sin and demons were real. So
well,
literally right
are.
Now,
they
over
are.
Your over your shoulder,
yes!
over my shoulder, waiting for us to sin is a demon.
Yeah.
And so growing up with that, it was very... I mean, horror and religion go together very much.
Oh, God,
there's
yes.
a lot of gothic of right and wrong, black and white.
Oh.
So I was living with stories from the Bible that were all about decapitations and the death of infants and fathers killing sons. Fathers killing sons is a big deal.
It's a big deal.
It's caught often happening inside of the Bible, at least in
it's a literary, a lot of literary genres focus on this father-son relationship.
Oh, yeah. The old devouring, the old trying to devour the new. And so I was growing up in a spot where I was in the spotlight from all of my peers. I was just immediately weird.
In the spotlight in a weird. Positive sense, a negative sense, or just as weird?
Very negative.
Ah, okay.
Very negative, Because this religion, one of its key things is being a fisher of men, right?
In
so
what
you're
sense,
literally
a
going
fisher
out.
Of men? You know, with a pole, the fisher?
Well, that's a quote from the Bible.
Ah, okay, okay.
From Paul, Apostle Paul, where he basically says, be a fisher of men.
Mm-hmm.
Paul's like the dirty, rotten
I
guy
know.
In this.
He's yeah.
temperamental guy who goes and causes all this colonialism and things because we got to make sure everybody knows this story. But anyway, because of that, my thing was as a kid, I was defrauding all of these cultural things. Like we're heading into Christmas now. As a kid, I'd be like saying, well, you know, there's a lot of satanic and pagan things involved in the Christian spirit. And, you know, and the idea of there being a Holy Ghost is an aberration to, you know, I'd be saying all these things because that's what my parents told
but you,
me.
But
so I think everything's true.
Oh, so you were not against what your parents were saying. You were you were just, you know, selling it to others.
I was there.
Ah.
Yeah, I was selling it to others until 1976 because at that moment I was like, okay, what just happened? I gave away. I mean, I was beaten up over this stuff.
I bet.
Was ostracized, all sorts of things. And I felt weird.
Mm-hmm.
And I was also a weird kid So I sinned a lot.
Wait a minute. With the sin, all right, now that gives me an in. I mean, were there love, romance in this moment? Is that part of the sinning? I mean.
Oh, sure. Well, yeah. I mean, there is a certain amount of that. Yeah. I was a weird, twisted kid. Uh-huh. And a lot of that came from forms of abuse. So in some ways, you know, some of the things that were done were transferred into, oh, this is how you show affection to other people.
Oh, and I see.
And also being, I kind of got very voyeuristic at a certain point because I didn't want to be around.
At that age?
Yeah, at that age. And so I got in a little bit of trouble over that because I felt like an outsider all the time. Mm-hmm. And so it was kind of like, let me sit on the sidelines and just listen.
Now that's interesting. Now that really is interesting, this voyeuristic moment, because it really shapes the future of your observation skills.
Sure.
And where it may have, and you know, this is just coming out of my head, you know, but what's interesting about that? I mean, you could take that to the bank, straight to the bank. I mean, because that is, I mean.
Some therapists did.
I'm sure they did. Okay, so now it's 1976.
Right. Yes.
And so what happened then? Did you just, you know, about face? What happened then?
Well, I was in kind of open rebellion, but I was only 10 years old or 9 years old at that time. So at that point, I'm stuck in the house until I can get out.
Oh,
and so there's a divorce that happens, and that's ugly, and that's against the religion. So they were both of them were kind of ostracized. Mm. People would not in the religion were not able to talk to them. So the thing about cults, not that I need to tell you, but the thing that I've seen about cults is that they create a society where you completely rely on the people that are in the cult, and that's it.
Yeah.
Everyone else is an outsider. So the threat of being abandoned is a tool that's used all the time.
Yes.
And so the abandonment and not giving you social skills, one of the things that I had a problem with is that I didn't have a ton of social skills that were outside of how I spoke with the people who were in this religion, which is very stilted shit.
Yeah.
Right? It's not how you normally talk to people. Yeah. So, you're kind of at a disadvantage, and I found myself in that disadvantage as I was going through my early
adolescence
years. And then I just went into total rebellion.
Give me a couple of examples of rebellion in that
Just bring in heavy metal music was like into the house.
I get it.
Going out partying, drinking, going to concerts that were considered. I mean, back in the 80s, it's funny to look at now, but the idea of Satanic Panic, the whole thing of people taking this music so seriously and having an international attack against it. It was taking matters, risk of not life and limb, but you might get beaten up going.
Yeah, sure. Let me ask you, did music enter your life at that time? I mean, did you have a skill in playing something?
Ooh, that's an interesting question. I was never very good at an instrument, but music became a huge, it wasn't just a spectator sport.
Mm.
It's kind of like how I am with horror. I couldn't just be on the sidelines. I took it down to it was much more deep. Like when people say music is my life, I was one of those music is my life people. And I do make a connection between horror and music, which is they both, you feel them long before you intellectualize them.
Okay, wait.
They're primal.
Now, you hit on a very important point, because if you transfer that to the notion of the horror genre in the media, in my mind, and I'm asking you, but to my mind, you cannot not write that. I mean, so my next question is, do you create horror in some way?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. Come on, tell us.
Short stories.
Oh!
Yeah. I write short stories. But basically, it's almost like, you know, one of the things that I joke about a little bit is that I'm a dirty druid. I go into the Oakland Hills and I do all sorts of stuff in the woods.
Yeah.
And there's a certain degree of like a weird spirituality that I believe in, where the things that you create in art.
Yeah.
Like bardic stuff that a druid would do, they have a power. So I have a crazy amount of decoration that I do for Halloween.
Uh-huh.
People come and drive to my house to see what I do every year. And that to me is giving back to the community some of this energy. Because when I was a kid, I wasn't allowed to celebrate any of these things.
Oh.
But my dad would let me go see the house that was decorated deeply. And I would sit there for an hour looking at everything, going, look at that. There's a head in this box.
No.
I would just sit there absorbing all this stuff. And so I decided if I ever got a house, I'd be doing that too. So from early on, when I realized that horror allowed me, horror as in art, as in music,
mm-hmm.
whatever that horror is, that allowed me a safe handshake with my own anxiety.
Oh.
That it was a place where I could control. Like, the thing is, the world is full of monsters.
Oh,
monsters are metaphors.
Yes.
And monsters are metaphors for the thing that I can't speak to, which is kind of like music does. Music hits on the emotion I can't bring up. And so to me, I look at it as I can turn off the movie anytime.
Yes.
I can close the book. But if I don't, I'm rewarded by making it through whatever this is, right? My real world, I can't control the madness that's out there, but I can control what happens in a horror film. So I project that kind of thing into the movie.
I can't wait to go watch a movie now as soon as we hang up. But let me get back to the creation. So you're in the mountains there in the cave creating these stories. So you mentioned short stories. Is that the only thing that you do? I mean,
oh no!
Oh,
I wrote a book.
Oh, well, so the book, but thing, yeah, but the book is
pleasure.
Hold
my
on.
Podcast has a ton
yes.
of things.
Okay,
but
of
also
course.
Just going out and doing spoken word. One of my favorite things to do is to go to conventions and just get into good, hard, long conversations with fellow fans. It's it's the art of that discussion that matters. And I've done like makeup effects. I worked on a couple of horror movies that never came out.
But keep trying.
Back in the 80s and 90s.
No, you've got to pick them up again because they, you know, dust them off and then, you know, get it to. I mean, look, I have to. Why I was so interested in meeting you, Scott, is that I'm in Italy and I am half Italian, half American. I go back and forth. I have a sister there. So I go back to the hunting ground, greater New York, where I, you know, grew up.
Yeah.
And
I can tell. I can hear
you can hear it. Yeah. And
I'm old Philly. So.
Oh, that's my favorite city, Philadelphia, as a matter of fact. Philadelphia and Montreal. Those are my two greats.
Ooh,
after New York.
Yeah, well, New York is its own palace.
Yeah, there's Chicago is coming in later on, you know. But anyway, when in this, I have a nephew, who my sister's son, and he told, you know, he got me into, he's been teaching me that people his age love monsters and people who come from the dead, and, you know, all of this. And it was just unbelievable for me. I couldn't understand the pull of that. And so I thought, I've got to talk to this guy because maybe he'll open it, you know, maybe he'll make me understand why. Because they are monsters that come back. The vampires, you know, the vampires are really special. I mean, there's blood there. That's a special type of monster, and that's a special,
very
genre.
Sexual.
Yeah,
you know, there's a ton of things going on in vampires.
Yeah, and you know, because I'm really tired of writing garbage. I write a lot. I've written a lot of books, a lot of articles. I'm like an academic. People, you know. But now I want to get down to the nitty-gritty, like paranormal romance. I can't do the vampires, but paranormal. And so tell me, is that linked, the horror genre, with the because I thought it was linked to only a certain age group that loved those vampires, people come back from the dead. But I see that maybe I'm wrong. I mean, is it just generalized, or is there a market more among, say, millennials or the Z generation?
Of course. Yeah, I'm a Gen Xer myself, and or a cusp. I like to say I'm a cusp. I'm not quite a baby boomer, but I'm almost there. I reeled into the Gen X. But I think that we can kind of thank the baby boomers in a way. I think if you go all the way back to Victorian England, you can thank Victorian England, because the ghost and the monster became metaphors right around Mary Shelley's time. Mm-hmm. You know, you have...
What years are we talking about?
Mary Shelley predates Bram Stoker.
About...
So Frankenstein.
Okay, Frankenstein,
So Frankenstein, if you look at it, you can just sit there and say, well, this is a story about a guy who creates something out of the pieces of dead bodies that were criminals, right?
Yeah.
That's a pretty disturbing thought in and of itself. But it's also if you look at it, you take a look at it, it's somebody talking about how... Like we had the golem before, the clay beast that the rabbi brought to life to go and do these things. Instead of it being magic, it's now electricity. Right? It's now the industrial age.
Yes.
And so there is this thing that I love to talk about with Mary Shelley and Frankenstein, is that there's an adult way to look at that, which is this is kind of a comment on the industrial age. And people forget that when the Industrial Revolution happened, people died a lot because there was no OSHA or anything. People were, when they started doing trolley trains in Chicago, it was common for the L track to fall off and crush people who were walking underneath. This was progress. So there were people who were being, you know, torn to pieces. She's making this right during a world war. So people are coming home with pieces of them missing. So the idea of body horror, the body being taken apart and blasphemed by industry is kind of there in her book. And I love that you have a guy who creates this and then rejects it, right? You know, Adam, the creature in Frankenstein, is rejected by its father and is shunned and banished, but it never leaves. It comes right back. So to me, there has always been this literary piece. M.R. James, the ghost stories of M.R. James and Algernon Blackwood, all of these folks who wrote stories about ghosts, they weren't writing them for kids. They were writing them for adults. And if you look at even Christmas, you know, Christmas is all about ghost stories. You know, in Victorian time, they told ghost stories every Christmas day or Christmas Eve. And then you'd wake up and you get your presents and stuff. But that is where the original Christmas Carol comes from.
Yeah.
Dickens, it's three ghosts, right? So that was a very popular one that created Christmas being what it is right now. But to me, it kind of goes into child's play for a while. Then you get to the 1930s where the first Frankenstein Universal monsters are there. And that is speaking to, we're coming right out of a depression, right? We're still in a depression. We're in the throes of a depression. We're looking at aristocracies as the monsters. So you have a scientist who's, you know, causing these blasphemies. You have a rich guy who's living in the hills of Transylvania in a rotted old thing. He's sucking on all the young people. You know, this is Dracula, right? You have the wolf man is the id coming out. You have all this stuff that's happening. A werewolf. Oh my goodness. You know, foreign people who are dangerous you know, at certain times of the year. You know, all of this stuff is really coming out of our id. If we really want to know what we were scared of, watch the horror movies of any generation. So once you get through that, you get to World War II, though, everything turns into kiddie stuff because we have a real monster that everybody's much more worried about, right? So in the 40s, horror movies suddenly become comedic. You have Abbott and Costello meeting Frankenstein
because those
things aren't scary anymore. Vampires and stuff aren't scary. But the baby boomers fix that. You know, baby boomers are the first ones that really get a TV. They get to watch the Frankenstein movies. And there's so many baby boomers that they change the culture. You know, we are still going into what our favorite things are. Pop culture was driven by one generation, yeah. and we've all kind of hung on to that. So it became something that was used to be greasy kid stuff, but horror movies started to bring in social commentary and metaphor. And in 1968, George Romero makes Night of the Living Dead. Roman Polanski makes Rosemary's Baby. And Peter Bogdanovich does Targets. And these are three horror movies that come out that are speaking to 1969, not Dusty Castles. And I think we've been on that run since. And I think as the world gets crazier and pop culture and the lines between pop culture and regular culture have blurred completely. So at this point, monsters are more palatable. When I was growing up, you were really kind of considered having arrested development, liking horror movies. Like, oh, poor little Scotty, let's pat him on the head and put him in the corner. He likes monster movies. But I think these days, when we're searching for heroes and villains in the way that we are, I mean, the Marvel Comics universe is so huge because of a thirst for heroes. What I like about it is that they are not sugarcoating these heroes. The heroes are flawed in every one of those shows.
Yeah,
and I think that that's a sensible way to go. That's the Joseph Campbell way to go. So we have this whole thing that for now, I believe that monsters are the more useful metaphor for the generations that are here now that are talking about the why did the zombie become so big? Well, I think because we're really thinking that the world could end at any given moment. We hope that we can have the survival skills, but also zombies are a metaphor for anything. They can be a metaphor for disease. They can be a metaphor for zealotry. They can be a metaphor for dispassion, you know, basically giving up on the human race. It can be communism. It can be socialism. It can be capitalism. It can be consumerism. All of those things have been used by filmmakers by taking a zombie and putting it in there. What I love to say about horror is that you can talk about things you normally would not sit and watch a movie about if you make it a monster. Monsters are metaphors. If you want to talk about child abuse, you may not want to watch a movie about child abuse, but you might watch The Babadook. You might watch a movie that has a creature that's doing something to kids. You know, you can have, I love that horror movies like The Babadook, and that's really not so much about child abuse. It's more about grief. Horror movies are now talking about cowardice. They're talking about grief. They're talking about the horror of a mother no longer realizing she
when
loves
you say
her kid.
Now talking about, I mean, how recent are we talking?
I think horror's always been touching on it, but I think we're being much more overt about it now. And in a way, some parts of me are happy about that, and other parts of me go, you know, it's always better if you keep it in the subtext.
Why?
Don't make it the text.
Why?
I think in subtext, it just can be interpreted
in different ways.
Differently
for everyone.
You don't feel you're being You don't feel you're being forced. Something.
Give us an example. Give us an example of it being in the subtext, and give us an example if you can, and it being overt. That would help.
Sure. I think one of the best examples, the best subtext horror movies I've ever seen are the Invasion of the Body Snatchers. So there was one that was made in the 50s. There was one that was made in the 70s. There was one that was made in the 90s. And I think each time it represents perfectly the paranoia or the upset that's happening in the culture. So the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers was directed by Don Siegel. Don Siegel went on to be known for Dirty Harry, the Dirty Harry movies. So he was very much, by the time they were making Invasion of the Body Snatchers, he had already made some Red Scare films. He was very conservative.
What do you mean by Red Scare? Communism?
Sure. Communism. Okay. So there were movies, of course, in the early 50s. We were sure the communists were taking over the country. They were infiltrating different areas. You had the House of Un-American Activities with Joseph McCarthy, Senator Joseph McCarthy. And during all of that happening, you have this movie with this director. It's written by a guy named Jack Finney, who wrote it in a science fiction book, a compendium of stories. And it's written for the screen by, I forget his first name, but his last name is Llewellyn. He was a blacklisted writer.
Yeah, yeah.
So he was on the more liberal side, mm-hmm. right? So you have a very conservative guy directing it. You have a guy who doesn't care, who wrote the original story, who just sold it to a pulp magazine. And then you have the writer who is putting in subtext, who is liberal, right? What I love about the Invasion of the Body Snatchers is that you have this story of people who look just like you. All you do is you go to sleep, right? You're no longer thinking, you're no longer active. As soon as you go to sleep, which could be you've politically gone to sleep, you've socially gone to sleep, you've emotionally or physically. So you go to sleep and you wake up and you look just like everybody else, but you know what? You just don't seem to have much emotion. You don't care. Empathy is gone. Empathy is gone. And so you have these monsters that are doing this. Now, why I say this is great subtext is that when that movie came out, up to this day, if you read books mm-hmm. on this movie, you will see some people who will say this is a comment on McCarthyism.
Right.
It's an anti-McCarthyism film. Mm-hmm. And then there are other books that when you read it, they say this is an anti-communism movie.
Yeah.
This is about how communists are taking over the world.
Yeah.
Don Siegel, for his credit, never hit you over the head either way. He said, let the audience figure that out.
Yeah.
So it's almost like, have you ever heard of the Kuleshov effect? It was an editing thing.
No, I've never heard of it.
So the Kuleshov effect was early in silent film. A director named Kuleshov mm-hmm. just shot a picture of a guy going like this, straight face, no emotion whatsoever. Then he took pictures of boiling water, a baby crying, and a tombstone. And he cut them together. And he put the person's face there in front of the tombstone, and then the person's face in front of the baby, and then in front of the boiling water. And he would ask people, what's the movie about? And they go, oh, well, the guy is sad because his wife died, and the baby's hungry because there's no food, and he's just boiling water. And then he would switch it around.
Yeah.
And he'd say, put the baby first, and then the guy's frowning face, and then the tombstone. Oh, the baby died, and he's sad, and he's boiling. He's going to kill himself. And it is what we bring to the story of the images when we are allowed to keep an open interpretation that allows you to see whatever you want in the film, and that adds to the depth. So I think that's why on the subtext, the idea is still there, right? We don't want to be oppressed by some entity that is relying on us going to sleep so that they can take over and get rid of empathy for others, whoever the other might be.
Mm-hmm.
But what the specifics are come down to the viewer. They come down to the viewer. And that's why I love subtext, because to me, that's true art.
Mm.
Being able to speak to everybody.
Everyone. See, that's the key.
And yet still have a message. And your message will be yours. And I think I do agree with the artists who say, once I make it, it's theirs.
It's theirs.
Once
I
put it out there, it's theirs. They can interpret it whatever way that they
you
want.
You can't control
I'm trying to
the
think,
receiving.
There's plenty of movies that are way too messagey these days. Are in the horror. And I won't say a ton, but there are some that, as far as I'm concerned, they wear their subtext on their sleeve.
Yeah.
And so they're immediately upsetting half of the audience.
Right.
There was a non-horror movie that came out the same time as Get Out. Now, Get Out's a great horror movie.
Yeah.
They both talked about racism, right? The movie that was not a horror film was supposed to be up for the best picture. It was called Detroit. It was shot during the 50th anniversary of the Detroit riots, which all started with a black man being killed. And then the movie was going to take place on the anniversary of that. It was directed by an Oscar-winning director, Catherine Bigelow. It had all these stars in it, and it tanked.
Oh,
nobody went to see it. Not one person went to see it. Oh, well, not one. They had, I think they made $17 million for a $100 million movie, and that's that.
Wow.
And it closed immediately because the people who lived through the Detroit riots had the riot exhaustion.
Yeah.
They didn't want to be preached to.
Right, exactly.
The other side was saying, I already know this. I don't need to see this again. And nobody wanted to see it. But the movie that talked the most about racism in that year ended up being a horror movie that came out in February called Get Out that basically talked about allies that weren't really allies taking over people people and taking all their appropriation of everything that they stand for, mm-hmm. and telling them to be quiet.
Mm.
And the whole idea of the quiet place, I love that. Mm-hmm. I think there's so much that's in Get Out that you can unfold. And yet, it can just be a story about these weird people that take the brains out of one person, put it into someone else's body. But people were hungry to still talk about this subject.
Yeah.
They're not burnt out on race. They're burnt out on being told how to feel about race.
Yeah.
And so I think that's where horror is important. Horror allows you to talk about things you'd be like, I'm not going to go see a movie about that. Are you out of your mind?
Yeah.
I want to be entertained. But you turn the monster into something that is that subtext.
Yeah.
And I think that's been done forever, all the way since, like I said, Mary Shelley. I think it's happening a lot more now.
Yeah.
And in some ways, like I said, I'm happy with that. In other ways, because horror is becoming more accepted. But I'm also a little saddened when I think that there's lazy writing.
Where what do you mean? Give me an example of lazy writing.
Okay, let me see if I can come up. See, the problem I have is that once I see a horror movie I don't like, I just
shut it off. Like, okay, I know. Just turn it off.
I'm done.
I know.
I'm done. That doesn't really work for me. But I'm thinking about, let me see. Well, I would say George Romero, who did such a great job with Night of the Living Dead in 1968, his last couple films were so overt. He basically created a very liberal screed against the culture as it stands, which has a place, but it really felt like burning tires.
It had the
smell of burning tires. It was just too on the nose. And I think horror does better when you're not telling people.
I think
it works in all directions, not just on commentary. I think the best horror movies never explain why the monster's doing what it's doing.
Of course.
I think the idea of the unknown is so important, and the element
and
of surprise
so appealing.
Is so important to comedy and horror.
Yeah. We mentioned before we started recording about the shadow self and shadow work, which is so fascinating. And you mentioned the different ways subcultures help us to do help us, you know, that key word, help us. Yes. And I thought, I've got to hear that. Let's talk about the shadow.
Wonderful, yeah. I love talking about that, because why do I say it makes me happy and healthy? Well, I had mentioned earlier about there being a divorce in my family. Mm. That really ripped a lot of stuff apart, made me truly alone.
Yeah.
And there was a time when I wasn't talking to anybody. My communication had pretty much shut down. That happened a couple times in my life. When I got out of the military, I was one of those folks for whatever reason. Yeah. I don't know. I had a hard time acclimating back to civilian life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of went off the radar for a little bit. And I had
another just
time jump when
in.
I was working.
In that moment, did you ever experience out and out depression that you could have been diagnosed for depression, really?
Yeah, I think what I say is that most of the horror fans that I know who are really into horror, that are my age or slightly younger, those are people who had a really bad first act and they're having a fantastic second act. Somehow we've all learned
to cope.
I like that. Oh. And I think... Yeah, I think horror is a coping mechanism. And when we talk about the shadow, I go to the Jungian idea of the shadow.
Yeah,
the shadow self is this thing that's deep inside of all of us that, Jung had said, you can ignore your shadow self at your peril.
At your peril. Amen.
Yeah, at your peril. It will find a way to come out.
Oh, it will.
It will find a way to burst to the surface. Yeah. That's when you get divorced. That's when you end up on TMZ doing something horrible. Whatever it is, the child, that dark beast that's inside of you will get out. And so I see horror as a healthy handshake with that. I am looking at the dark side of me and accepting that dark side of me and then saying, just as you should with the shadow work, you can look at the shadow, you can dance at the shadow, don't become the shadow.
Mm-hmm.
The shadow is tantalizing, but at the same point, we need to have a healthy response.
Mm. Well, let's
so
say...
for me, I had abuse, all this stuff I needed to deal with. Shadow work has helped me a lot because we live in a society where we think that some emotions are bad, and there are no bad emotions. They're just bad responses.
Yeah, right.
You know,
okay,
to me, a lot of my it's like distress signals. Many of my emotions that were considered negative were distress symbols. Hey, you need to do something about this. Mm. It tells my body I need to do something. So spiritually, finding my way to the shadow and doing shadow work and coming to grips with where I was my biggest problem and other people were my biggest problem and I could not let go. Mm-hmm. All of those things that I found out through my shadow, I found an easy way to connect with that through horror films.
All right. Now I'm going to...
I did it with heavy metal as well.
I've got to, in Italian, there's an expression that says, I've got to break an olive branch in relation to the shadow. Because, I mean... we are not children. We know that life is life. Life is white.
Yes.
Life is black. Life is good. Life is bad. There are rich. There are poor. And we have these, you know, these two ends of the spectrum. Now, the shadow's there. Mm-hmm. It's not bad. It's not bad.
No.
Now, it depends on how you receive that shadow. Okay, so if we start from the perspective that you've mentioned dancing, and dancing comes, you know, conversare, it means dancing with the shadow, talking to the shadow, reasoning with the shadow, okay? That's something that will not go away. So if we say shadow work, it's just a little conversation, right? Because they're always going to, it's always, it could be fueled by the fears that we have, you know, that we all have.
The work is never over.
Yeah, we all have we have faces of fears, you know, we have limits and all that. Mm-hmm. But we could just embrace it, really. I mean, it's a best friend, right? Just like those horror movies.
Well, that's how horror fans tend to look at it, right? I think, and it can be subtextual. You know, the guy who is a friend of mine who's a horror fan may never, ever know who Carl Jung is. And yet, or know anything about, you know, shamanistic arts.
Right.
He may never know anything about that, yet he's still doing shadow work.
Yeah.
Because he's doing shadow work through the horror film.
Yeah.
He may not know why it matters, why he feels better after he watches a horror film if he's depressed. Why loud heavy metal music or punk music or whatever, you sweat like it's an exorcism at times.
Yes.
It's getting these primal things that are inside of us that, like, I say this a lot. I can't go to a psychiatrist and have him go, "So what's wrong?" And I go, that's the expression. Yeah, that's what's wrong. You know, I don't know how to articulate what I'm feeling. It's some emotion I can't work out. How can you ask me what's wrong? I don't know. But music gets past this, the brain, which sometimes is my biggest problem. It goes past that, hits the stomach and the heart.
Yeah.
Hits me in the gut, hits me in the heart. When I'm listening to music, one note can change my feelings. I always bring up A Hard Day's Night, you know. You have that first jing song, which is just a chord.
Yeah.
And then there's nothing for a second. There's that moment of anticipation.
Yeah, yeah.
And the first time you're listening to it, you feel anticipation and it's changing your mood. You're curious. The next time you hear that song, you hear that jing, you're happy.
Yeah.
You know what you're in for.
Yeah.
You know, you're about to have this thing. So music doesn't work on an intellectual level nearly as much as it works on an emotional primal level. And I believe that horror does the same thing. It takes care of those shadow moments that I can't articulate. I may never want to look at. And yet I'm looking at them. I'm allowing myself. Yeah,
expose.
I'm allowing myself to see the darkness
yourself
and be okay with the darkness.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so much of vulnerability. There's so much vulnerability.
Wait, let me, I have two questions here.
I'll keep you boggled all day.
All right, now there are monsters. We have monsters. What happens when the white goddess or the white god with the flowing long cape and light all around them is the bad guy? I mean, no one ever thinks of that. And there are cases, right?
Yeah. Oh, we're in a magnificent time right now. And I think, magnificent time is kind of like saying, may you live in interesting times in the Chinese proverb. We're really in this spot. But we're in an interesting place for horror right now.
Yes.
Because we have had all of this madness of
COVID.
Mm. I, being someone who was in a cult, I am seeing what's been on the news for at least the last decade. we have everybody in different cults.
Yeah.
We are definitely talking like they're a cult leader.
Yes.
And no one who's in a cult knows.
Yeah.
You know, they will never know. And so horror movies are now talking a lot about the white flowing robed guy being a problem. There's a South Korean miniseries on Netflix that you should watch called Hellbound.
Hellbound. I'm writing
and
it down.
And basically it starts with this guy sitting in a crowded coffee shop, and he's watching a timer on his phone. And it goes off, and he's crying. And nothing happens at first. And then there's this rumble, and everything starts to shake. And through the wall come these three muscular shadow monsters that begin tearing him apart. He runs out. Everybody has their cell phones. They're taking pictures of him. And they run out in the street. They're knocking cars over. And they burn this guy alive in the street, and all that's left is like these ashes. When they analyze the ashes, they're not anything that is on the periodic table. These beasts that are there say that they're taking this person to hell. All this gets said, all this is seen on camera. And the movie and the show is all about how do we interpret this thing that happens in front of us? And it starts prophets appearing out of nowhere. It starts having science trying to figure out what the heck is happening. It cannot be what we think it is.
Yeah.
And it brings up all these amazing philosophical things. And then you think it's only going after people who have sinned, right? The prophets start saying, well, this person was a child abuser.
Yeah.
And then it starts attacking babies
that
are just born. It's like, how could someone that's just been born have sinned? And it starts getting into this questioning. And at that point, that's when the cults start getting violent, when there's questioning of the dogma. And so this is an amazing show. And there are so many movies and documentaries out right now that are talking about the Nexium cult, cults for the Bhagwans up in Oregon, just the cult of being internet sleuths, where there's a murder and true crime aficionados are getting together. And they fuck people's lives up by just coming up with false pretenses. And the idea of conspiracy theories, all of this, in the middle of that, there's a charismatic figure that's telling everybody what to do. And every one of those people is considered a white robe person.
Yeah.
And so I think that horror is talking to, you know, comedy and horror are both doing the same thing. They're pulling away the emperor's new clothes.
Yeah.
They are talking to power at this point.
Their power,
And that's why I think a lot of people are angry with horror, saying, oh, I'm tired of it being so political.
Exposing,
Because it is exposing. Mm-hmm, it is exposing this criminality. And for me, that's something that really is important.
It's out of this world. You know, it's really out of this world because it's so new that I don't, you know, it will take many years before people can see it as that, if ever, you know.
I don't know if they'll ever. I think the bar always moves a little bit.
Yeah.
The line always moves a little bit. We go back to normal, it's going to be something that's not quite normal.
Yeah.
But it'll be better than this.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always going to be people who will pretend it never happened as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think that's an interesting deal.
And my other question
horror movies are about that, too.
My other question, and you in part started responding already, I was thinking, let's play a game of projecting. Let's project. Let's speculate, right? Speculate what could come from what we're experiencing now economically, psychologically, and politically, physically with the pandemic. Yeah. What could come out in horror? What could you see the next, who could be in these horror, in the horror genre? What would make up the horror genre coming, you know, in the near future?
That's such a great question. I think that what's amazing about now is that there's so many different threats, different monsters, that there's so many different genres that can happen. Excuse me, I'm going to cough for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
Pardon me. But there's, it's not like in the 2000s after 9/11,
yeah,
and we have the Abu Ghraib torture controversy.
Yeah.
We had torture porn.
Yeah.
all of a sudden overnight there were movies like Saw and Hostel that were all about tying people to chairs and cutting pieces of them off. That was talking directly to our anxiety.
Yeah.
Because we had basically a superpower saying, well, maybe it wasn't torture for if it was all for the good reasons. And I think that is where it gets into our id and har takes over and says, hey, we got to pull your pants down, spanky little hiney. Mm-hmm. You just said something rude. And I find that now we have so many different things. We have the pandemic. We have people who are on both sides. I mean, you have somewhere in the background, the factions that are truly out of their minds.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
From the left and the right, and they meet.
That's what I was thinking. It could be polarizing. There will be two different types of, you know, opposite ends of a spectrum type of horror figures.
Honestly, I think this has happened often. I think you go all the way back to the Black Death, the Black Plague, the Dark Ages.
Yeah.
I mean, we may end up in a Dark Ages because in desperation, when everything falls apart, when the center does not hold, the authorities will come in and say, this is happening because you fucking sinned.
Yeah.
And before you know it, all the power will be in the churches again. And that may happen. Yeah. Who knows? And who knows what the church might look like? It may not be the church that we know. It may be a church of some guy who's a charismatic figure. We don't know. But what ends up happening is we have these moments where it's like, okay, we put on the brakes. We go into this dark, dark period. And it's all based on fear. And then after that, you get the Renaissance. After that, you get the Industrial Age.
Yeah, like the Gothic, that, the a new Gothic period or coming out. And yeah, the Renaissance. I'm afraid to imagine what that could look like.
Oh my gosh, I have no clue. I think it'll happen inside we'll have a Renaissance in everybody's living room. It'll be a living room Renaissance. You know, we don't have to leave the house anymore.
Yeah, and I think all of that's what I'm worried about.
Yeah, I know. And I think that that's showing itself in horror right now. I think you're seeing the idea of us isolating, no longer speaking, lack of communication. Lack of communication is a huge thing that we're seeing in horror. In the future, I think we're going to be talking more about charismatic leaders lying to us.
Yeah, yeah.
Because what's going to happen is people my age who are now like trying to storm the Capitol, their kids are the ones who are going to see it out of context and realize how insane it was.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're going to be the ones that are going to write the stories that say, you know what? Don't believe anybody rich or don't believe anybody who owns media. Don't do your research. You may find that librarians and researchers may be the jobs of the future because they'll be the people who will actually sit and do the research and say, you know, that picture that you thought was real about this thing that happened last week, that's a picture from 1999. And it's really about a guy eating pizza. It has nothing to do with the plague. You know, all of this stuff, this misinformation, somebody is culling that and going, this is not true. And that voice may not be being heard right now, but I think it's going to be people who are document people, librarians and stuff.
That Scott, may be the people as you were talking three times during your talk, I didn't want to interrupt you, but you made me think of aliens. And the position of aliens in horror, because aliens seem to be very controversial as in life, in real life, and in the media. But I see that, and I'm asking you, aliens have a different position with respect to, you know, a vampire or a monster. They I'm not sure. Do they have the status of monsters? I don't think that they have been sufficiently photographed or imagined in the collective consciousness, and so we don't know.
That's a rich question. Yeah. That almost makes me feel like there's an answer in two parts.
Go ahead.
because there's two ways to look at this. Yeah. I mean, one of the things is that the alien has always been the crux of horror.
Yeah.
The other, in other words, known as the other. Mm-hmm. So to me, I always say that the horror movie is ancient. It's the second oldest story. So around the first campfire with the first men and the first tribe, the elder, the first story is thank you for being with us. Thank you, spirit, for giving us fire, and thank you for the food. And we are all family. As long as we're together, we have strength. I love all of you. Yeah. That's the first story. The second story is don't go in the woods alone. Yeah, there are beasts in there that will do, it's the cautionary tale.
Yeah.
It's how you define what your tribe is and what the boundaries of the tribe is. And the horror film is there talking about that, or the horror story is talking about the anxiety that's there. Now, with that said, the idea of alien as we look at it now, what I think that you're speaking about, we're in a time where the aliens are finally making the movies, which I think is very, very important, right?
Yeah.
We have
it's funny.
We never had a truly African-American horror movie experience.
Oh, right.
We had small films.
Yeah.
We never had one that was told. The stories aren't different. It's the focal point.
Yeah.
It's the perspective that's different. We have more women who are directing horror films. So we're getting a feminine perspective in the horror movie. We're getting movies that are made by Mexican-Americans. There's a horror movie that's made by Native Americans or natives that is based on a reservation, zombies coming to a reservation.
Oh.
It's a story that's telling the stories that aren't white Anglo-Saxon guys like me.
Yeah.
And so that lens I know in and out. Mm. That's been around forever. But now we're getting a lens where the aliens are telling the story and we're maybe finally able to find some.
It makes me laugh when the aliens are telling the story.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah,
I like
the aliens are telling the story and maybe we'll find empathy. Now maybe we'll understand.
I love that. I love that spin. I love that perspective. I like this. I'm taking notes. I like the aliens telling the stories. That paranormal romance with aliens, that's a real win-win. I like that.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I like that, too. I like the idea of connection in whatever way with supernatural beasts.
You make me laugh. I mean, we could go on, and I really hate to close this interview. Scott, it was so much fun. It was so much fun to have
you.
And thank you so much for being generous with your storytelling, because it interspersed, of course, with the rich historical background and the genre and how it's developed, but being so generous with your own personal experiences, which really made it so valuable for us to listen to. It was a pleasure, Scott. Thank you.
Well, thank you for asking questions I haven't been asked before, and making this it's a fun, safe place.
Yeah, it's fun, that's for sure. I don't know how safe it is.
We'll find out when we stop recording, right?
Thank you, Scott. Thank you. I hope to have you again back in the future. Bye-bye.
I'd be happy to. Bye-bye.